Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. European leaders called for beefing up their defense spending Monday after a Paris summit on Ukraine and the region's security amid concerns about an aggressive Moscow and declining support from Washington. The emergency meeting comes ahead of U.S.-Russian talks on ending the war in Ukraine, which it appears could leave out the Europeans. Lisa Bryant reports.
The summit called by French President Emmanuel Macron came as Europeans confront a shift in transatlantic relations under the new administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said European security was at a turning point. Ahead of the Paris talks gathering European Union, NATO, and British leaders, Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk described efforts to introduce competition between the European Union and the United States as senseless and potentially dangerous. Top U.S. and Russian officials hold talks Tuesday in Saudi Arabia to discuss Ukraine and a possible summit between Trump and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. Neither Ukraine nor the Europeans have been invited. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says his country is willing to send troops to Ukraine as part of any peace deal. Other European leaders say that's premature. Meanwhile, the foreign minister of Hungary, which is close to both Russia and the Trump administration, said the Paris talks undermine peace. Leaders in Paris also discussed ways to rapidly increase Europe's own defense capabilities and support for Ukraine. The U.S. has long pushed Europe to do more for its own defense. Now, with Russia gaining the advantage on the ground in Ukraine and Washington calling for NATO members to increase military budgets, Europeans are sensing an urgency to do so. Lisa Bryant, VOA News.
This is VOA News. Israel's military says its forces will remain in five strategic locations in southern Lebanon after Tuesday's deadline for their withdrawal under a ceasefire with the Hezbollah militant group. Lebanon's government has expressed frustration over another delay. A separate ceasefire in Gaza is also in doubt as the region marks 500 days of Israel's war with Hamas. Talks are yet to start on the ceasefire's second phase, which would release more hostages and see the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the territory. An Israeli official says four bodies are expected to be returned to Israel on Thursday. A Delta Airlines plane flipped while landing at Toronto's Pearson Airport and ended up on its roof on Monday, injuring 19 people. AP correspondent Mike Hempen reports.
The airport says an incident occurred on a Delta flight from Minneapolis and that all 80 passengers and crew members have been accounted for. Paramedics say three people are critically injured. Video shows the plane upside down on a snowy tarmac as emergency workers hose it down. It's too early to say what caused the plane to flip, but weather may have been a factor. The Meteorological Service of Canada says the airport was experiencing blowing snow and wind gusts. It's at least the fourth major aviation mishap in North America in the past month. I'm Mike Hempen.
Mexico says it's waiting for a new response from Google to its request that the tech company fully restore the name Gulf of Mexico to its Google Maps before filing a lawsuit. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Y que por eso en Estados Unidos el nombre del Golfo de México se ve Golfo de América si uno lo ve desde allá.
During a news conference Monday, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum shared a letter from Google saying the tech company will not change the name after President Trump declared the body of water the Gulf of America. Sheinbaum says the mapping policy violates Mexican sovereignty because the U.S. only has jurisdiction over around 46% of the Gulf, the rest controlled by Mexico and Cuba. The Mexican president also says we will wait for Google's response, and if not, we will proceed to court. I'm Julie Walker.
Vatican authorities said Monday that Pope Francis has a complex infection in his respiratory system and will require more targeted drug treatment. Officials said the 88-year-old Pope is suffering from a polymicrobial respiratory tract infection, but gave few details. Experts say that's not uncommon in older people with prior medical problems and should be treatable with the right antibiotics. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
an emergency meeting in Paris to discuss European security.
In the near term, it's all about what can be done for and with Ukraine, in anticipation of the United States doing less.
A key U.S. senator addresses President Trump's plan for Gaza.
One thing I will say, there's very little appetite that I've seen in the United States Senate for America to take over Gaza.
And live from New York, it's television history.
Over the years, SNL has left its mark on politics, too. From Chevy Chase's clumsy President Gerald Ford to Alec Baldwin's President Donald Trump, the show's impressions have shaped how Americans see their leaders.
Today is Tuesday, February 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A plane crashed in Toronto, Canada, late Monday afternoon. As of this writing, at least 17 people are injured, three of them critically. The plane, a Delta Airlines jet arriving from Minneapolis, crash-landed and flipped over on the tarmac and came to rest upside down. The Transportation Safety Board of Canada has opened an investigation. In other transportation news, a passenger bus plunged into an 800-meter-deep ravine in southern Bolivia, killing at least 30 people and injuring 15, according to police and local media. Authorities said their initial theory was that the crash was caused by speeding, with the driver unable to control the bus. The big story today, though, comes from Europe. European leaders met Monday in Paris to discuss ways to support Ukraine and their own defense capacities amid concerns about an aggressive Moscow and declining support from Washington. The emergency meeting, which comes ahead of U.S.-Russian talks on ending the war in Ukraine, which it appears will leave out both the Europeans and the Ukrainians. Lisa Bryant has our story from Paris.
The summit called by French President Emmanuel Macron came as Europeans confront a shift in transatlantic relations under the new administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said European security was at a turning point. Ahead of the Paris talks gathering European Union, NATO, and British leaders, Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk described efforts to introduce competition between the European Union and the United States as senseless and potentially dangerous.
There are two big issues on the agenda for European leaders. In the near term, it's all about what can be done for and with Ukraine. In anticipation of the United States doing less and possibly in anticipation of having to guarantee in some fashion a settlement or at least a ceasefire.
Ian Lesser heads the Brussels office of the German Marshall Fund Policy Institute.
The other longer-term question, which is in some ways even more serious, is how to secure Europe's defense with the United States potentially absent in the years to come. And there, I think there's very little consensus that that's a very big and expensive and long-term project for Europe.
Top U.S. and Russian officials were to hold talks Tuesday in Saudi Arabia to discuss Ukraine and a possible summit between Trump and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. Neither Ukraine nor the Europeans have been invited. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says his country is willing to send troops to Ukraine as part of any peace deal. Other European leaders say that's premature. Meanwhile, the foreign minister of Hungary, which is close to both Russia and the Trump administration, said the Paris talks undermine peace. Leaders in Paris also discussed ways to rapidly increase Europe's own defense capabilities and support for Ukraine.
Increased spending at home, increased defense production, increased sizes of armies, increased intelligence cooperation, increased training, all of this has to happen in addition to supplying Ukraine so that its own front line doesn't collapse.
Arisia Lutsevich heads the Ukraine Forum at the Chatham House think tank in London. She described a key security conference in Munich last week, which left Europe concerned about Washington's new priorities, as a wake-up call.
It's a different White House and it's a different team. And Europe, it was slow to realize that and to find the right words and to find the right package for this transactional world of America.
The U.S. has long pushed Europe to do more for its own defense. Now, with Russia gaining the advantage on the ground in Ukraine and Washington calling for NATO members to increase military budgets, Europeans are sensing an urgency to do so. Lisa Bryant, VOA News.
Meanwhile, U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said on Monday there is little support for the U.S. to take over Gaza in any way, shape, or form.
Well, I've been working for 2.5 years on a solution to the Palestinian file that Israel can live with and the Arab world can support. Bottom line is that no one expects Israel to do any kind of deal regarding Gaza or the West Bank that would lead to another October 7th. Nobody expects Israel to allow Hamas to stay in charge, and nobody believes that the PA is the right answer in this current construct. One thing I will say, there's very little appetite that I've seen in the United States Senate for America to take over Gaza in any way, shape, or form. I think that would be a difficult sell in South Carolina.
Graham was speaking to reporters in Tel Aviv following meetings between a visiting bipartisan U.S. Senate delegation and Israeli officials. The ceasefire deal between Israel and Gaza-based Hamas has been overshadowed by U.S. President Donald Trump's call for Palestinians to be moved out of Gaza and for Gaza to be taken over as a waterfront development under U.S. control. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal said that he believes there's another way forward.
My talks with King Abdullah convinced me that the plan that the Arab states will offer to President Trump provides a realistic prospect for normalizing relations, self-determination by the Palestinians, regional defense arrangements, and security for Israel. If those components are part of a realistic plan, it could be a game changer for the region.
Jordan's King Abdullah reiterated his opposition to President Trump's plan again on Monday. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Residents of eastern Congo's second largest city surveyed the aftermath of widespread looting that accompanied the arrival of the M23 rebel group, who's pledged to restore order. The M23 fighters moved into the center of Bukavu on Sunday. It marked the Tutsi-led group's most significant advance since seizing East Congo's biggest city, Goma, in late January. The capture of Bukavu, which is a commercial hub, and of the strategic airport, dealt a further blow to the Congolese forces and escalated a conflict that has fanned fears of an all-out regional war. Donald Trump may be the president, but billionaire Elon Musk is the focus for thousands of Democratic activists launching a protest campaign this week to fight the Trump administration's push to gut federal health, education, and human service agencies. Hundreds of protests are scheduled outside the Capitol, congressional offices, and even Tesla dealerships, with organizers hoping to send a pointed message to members of Congress that a coalition of Democrats and progressives is coalescing against Musk's rise as Trump's top lieutenant in his purge of the federal bureaucracy. The World Bank reported Monday that the economic recovery in Afghanistan remains precarious, beset by persistent challenges, including policy uncertainty, financial isolation, reduced foreign aid, and fragile trade relations with neighboring Pakistan. The bank found that persistent high poverty levels, unemployment, limited resources, and weak purchasing power continue to leave millions of Afghans vulnerable in a country reeling from years of conflict and natural disasters. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. And now for U.S. news, something a little different today. Saturday Night Live has been a staple of American television comedy for 5 decades now, launching stars and shaping culture. On Sunday night, fans and famous alumni gathered in New York City to celebrate the show's 50th anniversary. Aaron Rainin reports from the Big Apple.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
For 5 decades, Saturday Night Live has been a comedy powerhouse, shaping the careers of stars like Bill Murray, Eddie Murphy, Will Ferrell, and Tina Fey. Tonight, many of them are back to honor the show that gave them their start. Outside NBC Studios in New York City, fans gathered hoping for a glimpse of their favorite comedy icons and A-list stars. Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds. Jerry Seinfeld and actor Kevin Costner were among the big names who attended Sunday night's program, highlighting SNL's massive cultural influence.
It's a cultural experience for a lot of people. You know, they're the kind of heartbeat of comedy for most of America.
You could be relatively obscure and then suddenly from appearing on this show have a huge amount of attention and notoriety.
TV critic Allison Herman says the show isn't just about laughs. It has shaped generations of comedy and the way we see the world.
Saturday Night Live is the longest standing comedy institution in America. The longer it goes on, the more self-evidently important it becomes. It has repeatedly proved its own significance by minting generation after generation of comedy stars.
Over the years, SNL has left its mark on politics too. From Chevy Chase's clumsy President Gerald Ford to Alec Baldwin's President Donald Trump, the show's impressions have shaped how Americans see their leaders. Trump himself even hosted the show in 2015 during his first presidential run.
So I think in politics, as with everything else, SNL has kind of functioned as a bellwether. The performer's impression has crystallized something about the persona being impersonated in the public consciousness that hadn't really broken through.
Music has always been a major part of SNL. Over the years, legends like Prince, Nirvana, Beyonce, and Taylor Swift have taken the stage, and tonight's celebration is no different, with performances from some of the biggest names in music. As fans celebrate this major milestone, Variety's Herman says SNL's legacy is far from over.
It's kind of a singular phenomenon, and right now, the fact that it's gotten to 50 years and is going to continue to be on for the foreseeable future is as much proof of that as anything else.
50 years strong, SNL keeps the laughs coming. And who knows, in another 50 years, these fans' grandchildren might be here celebrating its 100th anniversary. Aaron Rainin, VOA News, New York City.
For more on Saturday Night Live and its impact, I'm joined by Amy Becker, a professor of communication and media at Loyola University, Maryland. She explains the show's format is one of the keys to its longevity.
You know, it has a changing and rotating cast, right? So it has kind of adapted to the comic talents of the time. It taps into what's going on in popular culture. So there's a range of guest hosts and also musical guests who are kind of, you know, they're there to promote their new movie that's coming out, right? Or show or album. But it's a site of exposure for them. But it's become this like cultural touchstone to be invited to host and to host more than once and things like that. So it is really this ground for emerging in new comics and also for celebrities and musicians to really perform and reach a large television audience.
I think one of the things that we lose sight of now when we watch the show is how groundbreaking, how different it was when it came out. Can you tell us sort of what was the media landscape like in 1975 when Saturday Night Live appeared on the scene?
Well, it was before I was born. So, you know, we're really still talking about a network medium, right? So a lot more of a narrow audience focused on certainly fewer media options. There's been a lot of talk of the history of the show now that with the 50th anniversary and documentaries and the Netflix film kind of highlighting the first broadcast. But they were really looking to fill a void and not show Johnny Carson reruns right on Saturday night. So it wasn't, you know, there was a need to fill the airwaves, but there was also not as much competition for eyeballs, right? With certainly fewer television stations and programs. So there really was not much on, right, on Saturday nights, and certainly nothing live of that kind of caliber. But it filled the void. And it was also a variety show, and variety shows, you know, it wasn't the first variety show, right? But variety shows have kind of come and gone in success. But I think that it had kind of a formula that worked and stuck around because it was constantly evolving.
Interesting. There's a lot of frustration going on right now with politics and with what's happening in Washington. Do you see this as a good thing for the show?
I think that the show is operating in a very different media environment. So people don't sit down and watch television live on Saturday nights anymore, right? They don't often, young people don't even really sit down and watch television. They watch TikTok videos and other forms of, you know, shorter pieces of entertainment. I think where SNL has been good, and they've always had kind of like, you know, commercials or recorded digital type, you know, like recorded content as well as live content. But I think that they've pivoted a bit more to things that can be shared online and go viral. And so I think that it's, the show is adapted to meet kind of the technological or media environment. I do think that, you know, they've also been criticized over the years for being a little bit too liberal and friendly to Democratic candidates. But I do think that they're making an effort to, you know, in recent years, go deeper within each administration and make fun of more folks in Washington than just the president. And I do think that people are certainly hungry for satire and comedy that pokes fun at and is critical of our current environment.
Now, with all apologies to my international audience, Professor, you grew up in the United States. I grew up in the United States. Saturday Night Live has given us so many iconic characters that have really become part of American culture for so long in a way that, you know, no other show could have done. What's your favorite Saturday Night Live moment?
So I grew up, when I first started watching Saturday Night Live and was allowed to stay up late, you know, I was in middle school, and it was the era of Wayne's World. So really anything with Mike Myers and Dana Carvey really was funny for me. So I loved Dana Carvey's impressions of George Bush at the time. But I think, you know, Wayne's World was my first, like, we really talked about those characters, right? Like my friends and I and what they, you know, and that, you know, spawned into a movie and all these other things. So I think for me, that was kind of the most important kind of moment because it was current. But, you know, my parents grew up watching, you know, I mean, they were adults, but they watched Saturday Night Live when they were younger and we were, you know, obviously in bed kind of thing. And so there were characters that were, you know, favorites for them. And so what's cool about it is that each generation, like, gets to pick their own characters. And it depends in part on when you were kind of first introduced to Saturday Night Live and first started watching.
Professor Amy Becker is a professor in the Department of Communications and Media at Loyola University, Maryland. Professor Becker, party on.
Thanks.
Things are heating up in the Indo-Pacific. China urged the United States to, quote, correct its mistakes. This after the U.S. State Department changed wording on its website about supporting independence for Taiwan. Fiona Jones of Reuters has our story.
China hit back at the U.S. State Department on Monday after it removed wording from its website that said it does not support Taiwan independence. Washington says the change was part of a routine update. China, which claims a democratically governed island of Taiwan as its own, urged the U.S. to, quote, correct its mistakes. The fact sheet on Taiwan, updated last week, retains Washington's opposition to unilateral change from either Taiwan or from China. But, as well as dropping the phrase, we do not support Taiwan independence, the page added a reference to Taiwan's cooperation with the Pentagon Technology and Semiconductor Project. It also said the U.S. will support Taiwan's membership in international organizations, quote, where applicable. Beijing regularly denounces any international recognition of Taiwan or contact between Taiwanese and foreign officials. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Guo Jiaquan.
The revision of the fact sheet on U.S.-Taiwan relations by the U.S. State Department, which seriously regressed its position on Taiwan-related issues, seriously violated the One China Principle and the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques, seriously violated international law and basic norms of international relations, and sent a seriously wrong signal to the Taiwan independent separatist forces. This is another example of the U.S. side's stubborn adherence to the wrong policy of using Taiwan to contain China.
The website update came roughly 3 weeks after U.S. President Donald Trump was sworn in to his second term in the White House, and one analyst said this reflects a shift in the Trump-era priorities. The U.S., like most countries, has no formal diplomatic ties with Taiwan, but is its strongest international backer. Taiwan's government rejects Beijing's sovereignty claims, saying that only the island's people can decide their future.
That's Reuters' Fiona Jones reporting for us. And finally, today in Central California, it's harvesting season for strawberries and citrus fruits. But some farm workers who are not legal U.S. residents are staying away from work following migrant roundups that are part of President Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration. Genia Dulo has our story.
Alejandra is an undocumented farm worker in California who does not want to show her face or share her last name for fear of deportation. She says she was on her way to work earlier this year when agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, started rounding up undocumented migrants around the city of Bakersfield.
That was on Tuesday when they started the raids. And on Wednesday, we didn't go out because we were scared. We heard and saw the whole day that ICE was being very active. They were in the key places where all the farm workers have to go through, where the citrus groves are. So the next day, I didn't go to work because I was scared.
United Farm Workers Union President Teresa Romero says two of their members were detained.
The farm workers that were deported have been here working for 15, 20 years. They don't even have a parking ticket. They were stopped in the street. It's not that they had a warrant against a specific person. They were just stopped by unmarked vehicles going home from work.
While the Trump administration says these first migrant roundups will focus on suspected criminals, U.S. Border Czar Tom Homan says it is only the beginning.
As the aperture opens up beyond criminals, you're going to see more arrests. I made it clear, if you're in the country legally, you're not off the table.
In Bakersfield, resident James Miller says deportations may create a shortage of field workers here, but immigration agents must enforce the law.
I think it's misleading when it was interpreted that they were going to raid the schools. So they have a job to do. And they should do it. Is it going to impact us? Probably so.
Another resident, JP Avalos, says the economic impact here may be significant.
We'll see 2-3 months time where when the Latinos and you guys, when this happens and they kick them out, let's see where your food costs are and what you guys got to do to get that, you know?
Neighboring Ventura County has also seen immigration enforcement raids under the new administration. More than 80% of field harvesters here are undocumented migrants, according to estimates by the nonprofit Farm Bureau of Ventura County. Maureen McGuire is the Bureau's CEO.
If we have mass deportation and we lose the labor force that harvests, there will be a lower supply of food for, you know, those individual commodities that are affected. And then the grocery stores will be in competition for who gets that limited resource. That will drive the prices up.
Alejandra says she went back to work picking carrots a few days after the roundups, but is keeping herself and her U.S.-born son out of public places in hopes of avoiding immigration agents. Genia Dulo, VOA News, Bakersfield, California.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.